Okay, Houston, right. We've had a problem here.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem.
Those words have become part of our pop culture history, just like Houston, Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed. During the halcyon days of Project Apollo in the late 1960s and early 70s, Houston was a call sign that referred to the Mission Operations Control Room at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. We'll talk to Houston ourselves, though not the one you might be thinking of, Rick Houston. He's the author of Go Flight, an inside look at the history and culture of the legendary space center. It's all new and all blue with a little red-white thrown in for good measure. Hey, Nolan, you've seen Apollo 13, right?
I have. Can you guess how old I was when I first saw that movie?
Was it, let's see, something between 10 and 15?
Yes, I was 13 the year that movie came out.
1995. Oh, we just gave away how old you are. Sorry, man.
That's okay.
Our guest is Rick Houston. He joins us via Skype. His book, Go Flight, offers a detailed inside look at the workings of NASA's mission control from the earliest days of the space program and into the era of the space shuttle. Rick, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to first start out, how did you first get interested in this and writing this book about the guys in mission control? Because we've, you know, read all the accounts by the astronauts and the workings of the machinery and everything, but this is really the first time I've seen something focusing on mission control.
Well, I've always been a history buff in general, but in particular of the spaceflight program. And I was working on one book about the space shuttle program called We'll Stop. And when I, in the process of doing that book, I was introduced to astronaut David Helmers, wound up doing a short kids book with David. And while I was in Houston to do the book, to do the interviews with David, I met up with Milt Heflin, who is one of the former flight directors at NASA, and he took me on a tour of Johnson Space Center. And we went to the robotics laboratory, and that was really cool. I got to shake hands with Robonaut. We went to the current International Space Station mission control room, and that was obviously a neat deal. We went to the neutral buoyancy laboratory where they train for the space shuttle, where they train for the spacewalks, and that was obviously cool. But then we walked into the third floor mission control room, the Apollo era MOCR. MOCR stands for Mission Operations Control Room. And when we walked into that room, I have never been struck by a more powerful sense of history. I have stood in the on the field where Pickett's Charge was made at Gettysburg. I have stood in Dealey Plaza where Kennedy was assassinated. And when I was standing in that room, it hit me like a ton of bricks that when Neil Armstrong said, Houston Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed, he was talking to that room. Later, when he said, that's one small step for man, but one giant leap for mankind, he was talking to that room. When the crew of Apollo 13 said, Houston, we've had a problem, they were talking to that room. And in that moment, I knew that I wanted to do something to honor the people that had worked there. And obviously, everybody knew about Gene Kranz from the movie Apollo 13. Most people would probably know something about Chris Kraft. But by and large, most people would not know about John Aaron. They would not know about Jerry Bostick or Bill Moon or Ed Findel, or any of the other heroes that worked in that room. But if I had actually written a book for every book idea I'd ever had, it would fill up 10 libraries.
One of the things that really stands out to me as I read the book is that these men were very young. You know, they didn't come from the most prestigious universities you might think of, like Stanford or MIT, Caltech.
Right.
Why was that? And how do you think it ultimately served the culture of mission control?
I think the biggest way that it served the culture was that it kept those egos in check. You know, you couldn't have somebody in a heated moment say, well, I'm smarter than you are because I went to MIT, so we need to do what I say. There was none of that. John Aaron went to, I believe it was Southwest Oklahoma State. And, you know, Ed Findell has... Ed Findell is probably one of my two or three most favorite stories in the entire book. But Ed Findell has but a two-year associate's degree in merchandising.
And yet he finds himself involved directly in sitting in that room.
He was not only involved directly, he was in charge of Apollo Communications. Bob Carlton is another just amazing example. He dropped out of school in the ninth grade and then joined the Air Force and got the training that he needed. And one thing led to another. He landed at NASA. And as Eagle descended towards the moon, he was responsible for watching over Eagle's fuel supply. And in those last few seconds, you can actually hear Gene Kranz on the flight loop saying, Bob Carlton's the only one who's allowed to speak right now. And that's powerful.
Because they were getting down there on fuel.
Yeah. For a guy who dropped out of school in the ninth grade to be given that kind of responsibility shows the kind of trust that they had in each other as a team.
Another thing that really amazed me was a lot of times these guys would show up, and especially in these early days, is, you know, because this is all brand new, there's no manual for how to do this. They have to develop these procedures and all this, you know, it's just said, okay, you figure this out.
You know, when President Kennedy stood before Congress and said that we're going to go to the moon before the end of the decade, the United States had a sum total of less than 15 minutes of experience in human spaceflight. That was, I guess, less than a month or so after Alan Shepard's suborbital flight in May of 1961. And this team had to invent procedures. They had to write the textbook, the manuals themselves. Ed Findell learned how to read a schematic by coloring it with crayons. And one of the other things that was very important to this process was the simulations. And the sim supervisors were diabolical. They threw everything and the telephone book at these guys, and the ones who couldn't cut it were weeded out pretty fast. And it wasn't because they weren't liked. It wasn't because they weren't nice guys. But it was because the team had a job to do and they needed to be able to handle the heat of the moment, seat of the pants decisions that they had to make.
Well, of course, there were problems, and the flight controllers really became famous with the 1995 Ron Howard movie Apollo 13, starring Tom Hanks and the late Bill Paxton. How do the real flight controllers feel about how their world was portrayed in that film?
Oh boy, do you want the politically correct answer?
No.
Or do you?
No, I'm sick of that. Yeah. I want to know exactly what they thought.
I will put it this way. I think by and large they were very satisfied with the way that the mission control operations were portrayed in the sense that. Mission control was portrayed as being able to handle most any problem that came their way. This is in no way, no how, in any way, meant as any kind of criticism towards Gene Kranz, because Gene Kranz is, was, and always will be a legend of mission control, as he should be. However, as it is portrayed in the movie Apollo 13, he was the only flight director who was ever on duty. And I think that that kind of stuck. They would never admit it. They would never, ever, ever admit it on the record or in public. But I think that that kind of got some attention. I'll put it that way. I think that kind of got some attention with at least some of the guys.
Sure, but you have to, you know, when you're making a movie, you kind of have to do that. And you had the wonderful Ed Harris, who was nominated for an Oscar for that performance. But anytime you do a film like that, those characters have to be an amalgam of a lot of different people. You know, unfortunately for the other guys involved, it's just one guy. And that's one of the limitations with film, I suppose.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, Ron Howard's comment or response to that would be to say that it was not a documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that. And that's, you know, certainly, please, Lord, the last thing I need is for Gene Kranz to be mad at me. And I don't mean it as a criticism. But they're you know, he was portrayed as kind of saving the day during Apollo 13, when in fact there were a lot of people who were responsible for that.
Let's talk about that lot of people, and probably the two most famous missions would be Apollo 11, the first moon landing, and Apollo 13, the mission that, you know, where we nearly lost the astronauts on the way to the moon. Sure. With the oxygen tank explosion made famous by the movie also. What are some things that you learned about, like, that you could share with us, a couple of inside stories about, let's start with the moon landing. Give us one little tidbit that most people might not know about with the flight controllers.
I have a perfect one. Bob Carlton came into work the day of the lunar landing. He got off the elevator on the third floor there. And he was immediately met by somebody who worked for, I believe it was Grumman. Grumman was the maker, the manufacturer of the lunar module. And they told him then and there, however few hours were remaining until powered descent was scheduled for the moon landing. And they said, oh yeah, there's a problem with the fuel tanks on Eagle. And if the pressure gets to be too much, it could very well explode.
Wow. Yeah.
And Bob Carlton, if you think that I have a Southern accent, you should talk to Bob Carlton. He has a twang from Alabama that is absolutely hysterical. And to hear them tell that story, he said, I was clutched. And he said that he did not go to Gene Kranz and tell him about that problem because he said that he knew that Gene already had too much on his plate. And he said that he told himself that he would just watch those pressures very, very closely. And it was a problem. And obviously I can't explain it on the radio, but it was basically a problem where the fuel tank would expand like a balloon. And if it got to be too much pressure inside, it would pop like a balloon. And he was told that 2, 3, 4 hours before they were supposed to land on the moon.
Well, I think you did just explain that on the radio. So good job. how about Apollo 13? Give us a cool tidbit about that mission, because that was mission control during their finest hour.
I think it's not necessarily a tidbit, but the thing that truly impressed me about Apollo 13 was just how much of a sense of teamwork it truly was. You had the systems guys who watched over the lunar module systems and the command module systems on the second row, and then you had the guys in the trench on the first row who were in charge of the trajectory. And there was very much a sense of rivalry between those two groups. Not in a bad way, but in a in a teamwork kind of thing where we're good, you're good, and we'll see who's best kind of thing. But if the systems guys had not been able to figure out how to stretch out the fuel, stretch out the water supply and all the consumables that they needed to stretch out, it wouldn't have mattered if the trench had the trajectory figured out or not. And by the same token, it wouldn't have mattered if the systems guys had everything figured out. It was truly one of the best examples of teamwork this nation has ever seen.
You mentioned the trench. Can you explain to our listeners what the trench was?
Let's see. I'm an honorary member of the trench, so I need to do this right. The trench members were the best and the brightest of their generation. No, the trench guys, the trench positions consisted of the three positions, retro, Fido, and guidance, who were responsible for the trajectory of the spacecraft. They basically pointed the bullet where it needed to go. And they were called the trench because they were located on the first row of mission, on the first row of mission control. It's a tiered stair step kind of configuration. So they were on the lowest in the first row. And John Llewellyn kind of came up with the name the trench because he was a Korean War veteran, and he once remarked that it looked like there were a bunch of message canisters around from the pneumatic tubing system that they sent messages back and forth. And he was kind of well known for not sending his messages back the way that they needed to go right away. And so he had a pile of canisters laying around him. And he made a comment that it looked like he was back in the trenches of Korea. And that name kind of stuck. So John Llewellyn, John Starr, was responsible for many things in the trench, including the nickname.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Rick Houston, author of Go Flight, The Unsung Heroes of Mission Control. And we're back, and you're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. We're talking to Rick Houston, author of Go Flight, The Unsung Heroes of Mission Control, from 1965 to 1992, from Project Apollo through the early space shuttle years. Well, let's talk about when the pressure became a real thing, the tragic moments for the flight controllers, starting with January of 1967 with the loss of the Apollo 1 crew on the ground in the fire, to the Challenger disaster of 1986 and the loss of the Columbia orbiter in 2003. What are maybe a story or two you could share with us about how being in the room affected them during one of those tragedies?
One of the most harrowing stories that I heard of the Apollo 1 fire especially was Jerry Bostick arrived on site after everything had happened, and he found one of the trench members, actually one of the trench members who worked, I think he was a retro, kind of wandering around the parking lot, and kind of in a daze and just repeating the same words over and over, saying it had been so terrible, 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 because he had been on the console and, you know, listening to the audio. And of all the research that I've ever done for any book, that audio that from that Apollo 1 fire is probably the most haunting that I've ever heard. It is very, very tough and difficult to listen to.
And the other disasters were difficult too. Maybe could you share something with us about Challenger?
Challenger was actually flown out of the third floor mission control room, just like Apollo 11 was. And of all those memorable, amazing, patriotic, historic moments that room had seen, there was a camera that was focused on Dick Covey, who was the CAPCOM, the capsule communicator. There was a camera basically right in his face as he gave that famous, now infamous, command, go at throttle up. And the word comes back, Roger, go at throttle up. And you see Dick looking at a monitor just to his left, and he sees the explosion happen, and his mouth just drops. And I'm getting chills just thinking about it now. As many times as I've seen it, to see his reaction is just heartbreaking, because not only is he an astronaut, if I'm not mistaken, he had flown just a few months before himself. He knew these people. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were his neighbors. They were his friends. They were his astronaut candidate classmates. And he saw them perish.
Wow. And it must have been an incredibly difficult time for them. Did they have any kind of process to go through to get through this? Like today, we would probably, suggest counseling, but was there anything for them after an event like that?
Well, number one, after Apollo 1, Jane Kranz made a very famous speech the Monday after the fire, where he basically said, we're responsible for making this happen, for allowing this to happen. He basically told the team that from now on, we're going to be more vigilant. We're going to dot the I's, cross the T's, do whatever we need to do to make sure that this doesn't happen again on our watch. But I'm also very, very proud to say that my co-author on this book, Milt Heflin, was chief of the flight director's office when the Columbia accident took place. And there was a, can't remember her name right off the top of my head, but there was a lady that came in who wanted to go in and wanted to arrange counseling for the mission control team. And at first, Milt kind of, he balked at that. But after he considered it, he allowed it to happen. And he said, Rick, that was probably the best thing that I ever did in all my years at NASA. He said it allowed people to get things off their chest that they needed to get off their chest. And, I think that was a very powerful moment for him, especially, and I think Milt's one of the best friends that I've ever had. I text him daily. I would hate to think of the number of texts and emails that we've exchanged. But I know that he feels a great sense of, I don't know, obviously I can't speak for Milt, but I think he remembers Columbia daily.
Well, let's close out with a play tour guide for us. If somebody's going to go visit the Johnson Space Center in Houston, tell us what it would be like for them to go see the Moker.
Right now, I don't know that it's actually possible.
Can you see it at all?
I don't know, because there's actually right now, and it's one of the things I did want to mention, there's actually an effort right now to raise money to restore the Moker to its Apollo-era to its Apollo-era glory. The consoles that are in there now are basically just a conglomeration of shuttle-era consoles. They're not powered up. They're not lit up or anything like that. But there's an effort right now to raise money to restore it, to restore the room to exactly like it looked like, to either Apollo 11, Apollo 15, or whatever mission they choose, to where the consoles will be powered up. And I think that the restoration has, I think it might have already started. And, you know, that's kind of a touchy area with a lot of people right now, is the access to that room. You know, you can visit Independence Hall, where the Declaration of Independence was signed, but you can't sit on the furniture. And, you know, for several years, many, many people have visited that room and basically had free reign and have twisted knobs off consoles. They've ripped covers off the ashtrays on the chairs. And to be honest with you, I think there needs to be a very, very, very restricted access to that room.
To be able to see it, but not be, you know, able to sit in those seats and that kind of
thing.
Right.
To be able to go into the viewing room, I think that that would be
appropriate.
I think that would be appropriate.
Well, leave us with a sense of what it was like for you, because you did get to go in that room. Leave us with that last impression you had of being in there.
You know, I feel bad for saying that people should not be allowed to visit that room, because visiting that room changed my life. I walked into that room, like I said earlier, and I'm not ashamed to admit I had tears in my eyes, because I did not feel worthy to be standing there. I wasn't smart. I'm not smart enough to have worked in that room, and I never will be. I can't think on my feet like those guys were able to think on their feet. And it is, like I said, it's one of the most powerful senses of history that I've ever had. And I hope never to forget it. I hope that it came across in the book, and I hope that it comes across in the movie.
Well, Rick, thank you for spending time with us today and sharing these incredible stories about these guys that most people have never heard of. Everybody knows the name of Neil Armstrong, and many people know the name of Gene Kranz, or maybe Chris Kraft, who was the original flight controller, and the building's named after Christopher Kraft. But they don't know the names of these guys, so thanks for sharing them with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Rick Houston is the author of Go Flight, The Unsung Heroes of Mission Control 1965 to 1992. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Listen to this and past episodes at mynspr.org and subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or wherever you get your digital groove on. Follow us on Twitter at NSPRNews or me at Dave Shlom. For co-producer and the man who saves this show from his console every week, Nolan Ford, I remind you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.